Chapter 10 of The War of Antichrist with the Church and Christian Civilization. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Scott Foster. The War of Antichrist with the Church and Christian Civilization by Monsignor George F. Dillon. Chapter 10, Napoleon and Freemasonry. I shall have to ask your careful attention for a few moments to the leader who arose out of the first French Revolution, and whose military and diplomatic fame is still fresh in the recollection of many of the present generation. That leader was Napoleon Bonaparte. In the days of his greatest prosperity, nothing was so distasteful to him as to be reminded of his Jacobean past. He then wished to pose as another Charlemagne or Rudolf of Habsburg. He wished to be considered the friend of religion, and of the Catholic religion in particular. He did a something for the restoration of the Church in France, but it was as little as he could help. It perhaps prevented a more wholesome and complete reaction in favor of the true religious aspirations of the population. It was done grudgingly, parsimoniously, and meanly. And when it had been done, Napoleon did all he could do to undo its benefits. He soon became the persecutor, the heartless, cruel, ungrateful persecutor of the pontiff, and an opponent to the best interests of religion in France, and in every country which had the misfortune to fall under his sway. The reason of all this was that Napoleon had commenced his career as a Freemason, and a Freemason he remained in spirit and in effect to the end of his life. It is known that he owed his first elevation to the Jacobins, and that his earliest patron was Robespierre. His first campaign in Italy was characterized by the utmost brutality which could gratify Masonic hatred for the Church. He suppressed the abodes of the consecrated servants of God, sacked churches, cathedrals, and sanctuaries, and reduced the Pope to the direst extremities. His language was the reflex of his acts and of his heart. His letters breathe everywhere the spirit of advanced Freemasonry, gloating over the wounds it had been able to inflict upon the spouse of Christ. Yet this adventurer has, with great adroitness, been able to pass with many, and especially in Ireland, as a good Catholic. Because he was the enemy of England, or rather that England led by the counsels of Pitt and Burke constituted herself the implacable enemy of the Revolution of which he was the incarnation and continuation, many opposed to England for political reasons regard Bonaparte as a kind of hero. No one can doubt the military genius of the man, nor indeed his great general ability, but he was in all his acts what Freemasonry made him. He was mean, selfish, tyrannical, cruel. He was reckless of blood. He could tolerate or use the Church while that suited his policy. But he had, from the beginning to the very end of his career, that thorough indifference to her welfare and want of belief in her doctrines, which an early and lifelong connection with the Illuminati inspired. Father Deschamps writes of him, "Napoleon Bonaparte was in effect an advanced Freemason, and his reign has been the most flourishing epoch of Freemasonry. During the Reign of Terror, the Grand Orient ceased its activity. The moment Napoleon seized upon power, the lodges were opened in every place." I have said that the revolutionary rulers in France were all Illuminati, that is, Freemasons of the most pronounced type, whose ultimate aim was the destruction of every existing religion and form of secular government in order to found an atheistic social republic which should extend throughout the world and embrace all mankind. Freemasonry welcomes, as we have seen, the Mohammedan, the Indian, the Chinese, and the Buddhist, as well as the Christian and the Jew. It designs to conquer all, as a means of bringing all into the one level of atheism and communism. When, therefore, its directory, in their desire to get rid of Napoleon, planned the expedition to Egypt and Asia, they meant the realization of a part of this program, as well as the removal of a troublesome rival. A universal monarchy is, in their idea, the most efficacious means for arriving at a universal republic. Once obtained, the dagger with which they removed Gustavus III of Sweden, or the guillotine by which they rid France of Louis XVI, can at any moment remove Caesar and call in Brutus. They are not the men to recoil before deeds of blood for the accomplishment of their purposes. Now Napoleon, who was, as Father Deschamps informs us, a member of the Lodge of the Templars, the extreme illuminated Lodge of Lyon, and had given proof of his fidelity to Masonry in Italy, was the very man to extend the rule of republicanism throughout Asia. He appeared in Egypt with the same professions of hypocritical respect for the Quran, the Prophet, and Mohammedanism, as he afterwards made when it suited his policy for Catholicism. His address to the people of Egypt will prove this. It ran as follows, with true Masonic hypocrisy. Cadiz, sheikhs, imams, tell the people that we are the friends of true Musulman, that we respect more than the Mamelukes do God, his prophet, and the Al-Quran. Is it not we who have destroyed the Pope who wished that war should be made against the Musulman? Is it not we who have destroyed the Knights of Malta because these madmen thought that God willed them to make war upon the Musulman? Is it not we who have been in all ages the friends of the Grand Seigneur, may God fulfill his desires, and the enemy of his enemies? God is God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Fear nothing above all for the religion of the prophet which I love. The cool hypocrisy of this address is manifested by a proclamation he made on that occasion to his own soldiers. The same proclamation also shows the value we may place on his protestations of attachment to and respect for the usages of Christianity. The following is a translation of it. Soldiers, the peoples with whom we are about to live are Mohammedan. The first article of their faith is this: there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Do not contradict them. Act with them as you have acted with the Jews and with the Italians. Have the same respect for their muftis and their imams as you have had for rabbis and bishops. Have for the ceremonies prescribed by the Al-Quran for the mosques the same tolerance you had for convents, for synagogues, and for the religion of Moses and of Jesus Christ. We read in the correspondence of Napoleon I, published by order of Napoleon III, what he thought of this proclamation to the very end of his career. After all, it was not impossible that circumstances might have brought me to embrace Islam, he said at St. Helena. Could it be thought that the empire of the East and perhaps the subjection of the whole of Asia was not worth a turban and pantaloons, for it was reduced to so much solely? We would lose only our breeches and our hats. I say that the army, disposed as it was, would have lent itself to that project undoubtedly, and it saw in it nothing but a subject for laughter and pleasantry. Meanwhile, you see the consequences. I took Europe by a backstroke. The old civilization was beaten down, and who then thought to disturb the destinies of our France and the regeneration of the world? Who had dared to undertake it? Who could have accomplished it? Neither prosperity nor adversity changed Napoleon. He was a skeptic to the end. He said at St. Helena to Las Casas, "Everything proclaims the existence of a God. That is not to be doubted, but all our religions are evidently the children of men. Why do these religions cry down one another, combat one another? Why has that been in all ages and all places? It is because men are always men. It is because the priests have always insinuated, slipped in lies and fraud everywhere. Nevertheless," he continued, "from the moment that I had the power, I had been eager to re-establish religion. I used it as the base and the root. It was in my eyes the support of good morality, of true principles, of good manners. I am assuredly far from being an atheist, but I cannot believe all that they teach me in spite of my reason under penalty of being deceitful and hypocritical. To say whence I come, what I am, where I go, is above my ideas. And nevertheless, all that is, I am the watch which exists and does not know itself. No doubt," he continued, "but my spirit of mere doubt was, in my quality of emperor, a benefit for the people. Otherwise, how could I equally favor sects so contrary if I had been dominated over by one alone? How could I preserve the independence of my thoughts and of my movements under the suggestions of a confessor who could govern me by means of the fear of hell? What an empire could not a wicked man, the most stupid of men, under that title of confessor, exercise over those who govern nations? I was so penetrated with these truths that I preserved myself well to act in such a manner that, in as far as it lay in me, I would educate my son in the same religious lines in which I found myself." 2 months later, the ex-emperor said that from the age of 13 he had lost all religious faith. Thiers says that when Napoleon intended to proclaim himself emperor, he wished to give the Masons a pledge of his principles, and that he did this by killing the Duc d'Enghien. He said, "They wish to destroy the revolution in attacking it in my person. I will defend it, for I am the revolution. I, myself. They will so consider it from this day forward, for they will know of what we are capable." A less brave but still more accomplished relative of his, Napoleon III, in his Idée Napoléonienne, says, "The revolution dying, but not vanquished, left to Napoleon the accomplishments of its last designs. Enlighten the nations, it would have said to him. place upon solid bases the principal result of our efforts. Execute in extent that which I have done in depth. Be for Europe what I have been for France. That grand mission Napoleon accomplished, even to the end. When Napoleon obtained power, it was, we know, principally by means of the illuminated Freemason Talleyrand. By him and his confederates of the Illuminati, he was recalled from Egypt and placed in the way of its attainment. His brothers were, every one of them, deep in the secrets of the sect. Its supreme hidden directory saw that a reaction had set in, which, if not averted, would speedily lead to the return of the exiled Bourbons and to the disgorgement of ill-gotten goods on the part of the revolutionists. As a lesser evil, therefore, and as a means of forwarding the unification of Europe which they had planned, by his conquests, they placed supreme power in the hands of Bonaparte, and urged him on in his career, watching at the same time closely their own opportunities for the development of the deadly designs of the sect. Then they obtained the first places in his empire for themselves. They put as much mischief into the measures of relief given to conscience as they could. They established a fatal supremacy for secularism in the matter of education. They brought dissension between the Pope and the Emperor. They caused the second confiscation of the states of the Church. They caused and continued to the end the imprisonment of Pius VII. They were at the bottom of every attack made by Napoleon while emperor upon the rights of the Church, the freedom and independence of the Supreme Pontiff, and the well-being of religion. But the chief mistake of Napoleon was the encouragement he gave to Freemasonry. It served his purpose admirably for a while, that is, so long as he served the present and ultimate views of the conspiracy. For a conspiracy, Masonry ever was and ever will be. Even if Cambaceres, Talleyrand, Fouché, and the old leaders of the Illuminati, whom he had taken into his confidence and richly rewarded, should be satisfied, there was a mass of others whom no reward could conciliate, and who, filled with the spirit of the sect, were sure to be ever on the lookout for the means to advance the designs of the Weishaupt and his inner circle. That inner circle never ceased its action. It held the members of the sect, whom it not only permitted but assisted to attain high worldly honors, completely in its power, and hence in absolute subjection. For them, as well as for the humblest member of the secret conclave, the poisoned aqua tofana and the dagger were ready to do the work of certain death, should they lack obedience to those depraved fanatics of one diabolical idea, who were found worthy to be selected by their fellow conspirators to occupy the highest place of infamy and secret power. These latter scattered secretly amidst the rank and file of the lodges, hundreds of Argus-eyed, skilled plotters who kept the real power of inner or high Masonry in the hands of its hidden masters. Masonry from this secret vantage ground ceaselessly conspired during the Empire. It assisted the conquests of the victor of Austerlitz and Jena, and if Deschamps, who quotes from the most reliable sources, is to be trusted, it actually did more for these victories than the great military leader himself. Through its instrumentality, the resources of the enemies of Napoleon were never at hand. The designs of the Austrian and other generals opposed to him were thwarted, treason was rife in their camps, and information fatal to their designs was conveyed to the French commander. Masonry was then on his side, and as now, the secret resources of the order, its power of hidden influence and espionage, were placed at the disposal of the cause it served. But when Masonry had reason to fear that Napoleon's power might be perpetuated, when his alliance with the imperial family of Austria, and above all, when the consequence of that alliance, an heir to his throne, caused danger to the universal republic it could otherwise assure itself of at his death, when, too, he began to show a coldness for the sect and sought means to prevent it from the propagandism of its diabolical aims, then it became his enemy, and his end was not far off. Distracting counsels prevailed in his cabinet. His opponents began to get that information regarding his movements which he had obtained previously of theirs. Members of the sect urged on his mad expedition to Moscow. His resources were paralyzed, and he was, in one word, sold by secret invisible foes into the hands of his enemies. In Germany, Weishaupt and his party, still living on in dark intrigue, prepared secretly for his downfall. His generals were beaten in detail. He was betrayed, hoodwinked, and finally led to his deposition and ruin. He then received with a measure, pressed down and overflowing, and shaken together, the gratitude of the father of lies, incarnate in Freemasonry, in the Illuminati, and kindred atheistic secret societies. Banished to Elba, he was permitted to return to France only in order to meet the fate of an outcast and a prisoner upon the Rock of St. Helena, where he died abandoned and persecuted by the dark sect which had used, abused, and betrayed him. So it has continued, as we shall see, to use, to abuse, and to betray every usurper or despot whom it lures into its toils. We shall now glance at its action, the action of Freemasonry After the Fall of Napoleon. End of chapter 10.